Jim Chambers, Reel 4.
The operation they've carried out from Moratime would be in a Catalina, and they would go to nearby islands that were occupied by Japanese troops, and they'd land, obviously, on the sea, and invariably some of the locals would come out in their canoes, On a few occasions, the luckless person would be dragged into the Catalina and flown off back to base, where it'd be interrogated, and all the knowledge they could gather about the Japanese on the island.
This Allied Intelligence Bureau, was that just a cover name for SOE?
I don't really know. It was one of those. I'm sure that it was, in some regards. It was whether it was an American organisation or not, I don't know. But this is the name that they used. And it was American and Australian and just a few British. And on one occasion, the Catalina went out and the team actually went on to the island, and they got involved in a gunfight with the Japanese, and one of the Australian officers was killed. He did the unforgivable. He went up to a Japanese body that was laying down, who he thought was dead, but the man wasn't dead. And he picked his gun up and shot the officer. So, I can't think. The invasion of Borneo was carried out by the Australian army, and we were taken to Labuan in a landing craft, where was set up the base station again, and that's where we came into contact with Major Tom Harrison. And they were dropping into Borneo interior and organising the local tribes to ambush and harass the Japanese generally.
So you helped set up the base at Labuan, did you?
Well, it's not really setting up the base, because they were the transmitter receivers were two American trucks. We had two. They both had a receiver and a transmitter, and they also had their own power source, which was a generator driven by a petrol engine. So that was used for us to be in contact with the units in the field in Borneo.
Were you actually in the town?
Well, they didn't have a town as such on Labuan. It was, I don't know what you call it, really. There is a place on there called Victoria, but I don't know that you would call it a town. It's just a street with a few houses either side. It used to be.
But you personally were transmitting and receiving at Labuan, were you?
Oh, yes. Yes. Yeah.
To agents in the jungle?
In the jungle, yeah. Yes, I was always recall on one occasion I received, I was on duty at the receiver, because we used to keep a watch. There used to be a 24-hour watch. And I got this message coming through, and in radio they use the Q code. And the SOE adapted the Q code for their own use, so that when this message, this Q sign came through, which was QUG, it means that I'm in imminent danger, and we'll try and contact you on my next schedule. And this was coming from Harrison's operator. Lieutenant Edie, I think his name. Anyway, I took this message that came through, and I thought it was most garbled, because you must remember that I'd been receiving and sending messages in groups of five letters for a couple of years. So, I mean, it was just my habit to do that, to break up all these things into five. And when I subsequently, well, when the message subsequently finished, which wasn't very long duration, I looked at this and I was just completely baffled. But when I looked again, I saw that it had been transmitted in longhand. And I took this immediately to the officer on the station. And the message briefly stated that they were in imminent danger. The Japanese were after them. And what they needed was a flying boat to go to the coordinates that they'd sent to pick them up and get them out of it. And that was done. But that's the first time I've received a message in plain language. So obviously the Japanese didn't have any radio listening points around there.
I think we should say that this Tom Harrison is the Tom Harrison of mass observation fame.
Yes, yes, he was quite well known, really. And also he had, I think, been there previously, but by previously I mean before the war, as an anthropologist. And he I think he knew the language of most of the tribes. So, yes, he was well suited for the job.
What kind of a man was he?
Well, very brusque that I can remember. Didn't have a lot of contact with him. Just the usual officer and other rank contact, really.
But you told me earlier that he wanted to go and study pygmy rhinoceros.
Oh, yeah, that was after the Japanese surrendered eventually. He said that he was going to go off into Dutch Borneo and look for a pygmy rhinoceros that he'd heard reports of. So whether he actually ever found the thing or not, I don't know. But that was the last I saw of him. He's written several books, I believe, on his experiences in Borneo.
What were conditions for transmitting and operating like in Borneo?
Oh, well, where we were was okay, yeah, sure. Yeah, because we were at this base station with these vehicles. But I think it was a bit arduous for the actual people in the bush. But I don't think they actually sent many messages as such. It would just be that they needed to be taken out, really.
Was it the same equipment that you'd had in France?
I can't really remember. Can't remember, really. Don't know. I can't recall seeing any of the stuff they used in the field. No.
What was life like for you in Labuan?
Oh, pretty dull, really. Awful climate. I don't know what the humidity rate is there. It's pretty high. It's like drowning, really. Just a blanket of heat. Never no interest. Well, I say that's incorrect, really. But whilst the Australians were there, we had open-air cinema where they would put on a film show once or twice a week. We'd sit in the jungle with a screen up and watch some old film. But when the Australians left, when hostilities ceased, we were left there. The small British contingents were left there and come over under the control of the British administration unit.
Which other Englishmen were with you in Labuan?
There was some other people who were cipher experts and some other radio operators. I think these people came from a unit that was operating in France during the war. Forward. I don't know what their actual operation was, but I think they were called Special Force One, and they were just signals But what their actual operation was, I don't know.
But John Raven wasn't with you.
Yes, he was. Yeah, John Raven was there. Yeah, yes, because oh, on one occasion, John Raven was I don't know how it came about, but he was allocated a job on one of the ships that were nearby. He was a radio operator on that for some purpose. I've forgotten exactly what, but he was on that on board ship.
How would you have liked to have been an agent in the Borneo jungle?
I don't think I would like that at all, really. Because, unless you've actually been into the jungle, you've no idea. I mean, they don't talk about distance in miles, and they talk about it in time. It's not a, you know, a 10 miles up the road. It's a day's travel, or it's 2 days' travel, or whatever it is. And so, there were some Canadian Chinese troops. There weren't many of them. I think it was about six. And what was proposed that these Canadians would go through the jungle into Kuching, which is capital of Sarawak, to do sabotage and report on the Japanese strengths. But they assessed the time of getting there as being 6 weeks. So as the war was going then, they called off the operation. So that never took place.
What months do you think you were in Labuan for?
How many months?
Which particular months in 1945?
45. I'm just December. December. I should think it must have been somewhere in the June of 45, May or June 45.
So you were just there for 2 months?
No. As I said previously, we were seconded to the British Military Administration Unit. And this was after the Australians had left, the entire Australian forces had left Borneo and Labuan. So this British contingent of radio operators were kept there to set up the communications in Borneo, civil communications. And that was our purpose. And we were there until November 1946.
When you got the news of the end of the Japanese war and the atom bombing of Japan, how did you feel about that?
Very, very thankful. I was just looking forward to going home, really. Because we were a long way from home. And news was very sparse from home. It was a long way to get, a letter. Radio communication wasn't all that great from Britain to Borneo. So, yeah, we were over the moon, really.
But you didn't get home till 46,
Seven.
47.
Yeah, that was a disaster because once we were notified that we were to go to Singapore on our way home, they sent a Sunderland flying boat to Labuan. He landed and then found that it had some mechanical problem, couldn't take off. They sent another Sunderland from Singapore with some spares, and he landed. Didn't have the right spares and also suffered mechanical trouble. So he couldn't take off. And the upshot was that they sent a Dakota from Singapore to pick us up. And unfortunately, that the airstrip in Labuan had never been maintained. And the airstrips were made by the Americans, and that consisted really of felling coconut palms and laying them on the ground, and then filling that in with leveling it off really with sand, coral, whatever it was, materials they had available, so that it made a lovely landing strip for aircraft. Those temporary jobs. And obviously, since the Australians had left and the Yanks had left, the airstrip had never been used. So the continuous rain, it had made it like a corrugated field. Anyway, this Dakota came in, he landed okay. And the crew told us that the port engine, yes, I know, I remember it now, the port engine had an oil leak, but they never had a spanner, the proper spanner, to tighten it up to prevent the oil leaking. But the pilot said, well, we'd be all right to get back there. So we got onto the Dakota and took off for Singapore. And then I was sitting on the starboard side, and I noticed that there were flecks of oil coming onto the window. And I drew the crew's attention to this, and he said, oh God, he said, another oil leak, which is coming from the starboard engine. He informed the pilot, and the pilot said, well, he said, I'll go up to 15,000 feet. He said, and if it gets any worse, you'll have to dump your gear. He said, and hope we can glide into Singapore. And fortunately, it was all okay, and we landed at Singapore.
Now, going back to France, there's something that you forgot to add that we need to...
Yes, it just, I suddenly recall that, as I said previously, for some reason, the SAS group in the area had lost their radio communications. And they came to me one day and asked if I would send a message off to their headquarters, as they had learned that the German troops were retreating through the Belfort Gap, and there was quite a concentration of troops there. What they were asking for, in fact, was an airstrike. And I did this. I transmitted the message and got confirmation that an airstrike would take place. And the SAS officer that organised the airstrike was, as I knew him, was a Lieutenant Pinchy. And he decided that he would go with the Mackie to have a look-see at this airstrike. And they went off in two cars. And unfortunately, only one of the cars had the Allied white star on the roof. So these cars were travelling together. And the aircraft came over to do this strike. And it's believed that the pilot of one of them thought that it was a German car chasing a Mackie car or an Allied car, and anyway, he came down and he strafed this car, and unfortunately, Lieutenant Pinchy received a bullet in the head and killed instantly. And his body was brought back to Aubrive and subsequently buried.
So he was an SAS officer?
Yes.
Had you got to know him at all?
No, not really. It was just that they were operating in our group. They used to come in now and again to see how things were. Their activity in the area seemed to be to lay in wait for a German convoy to go by, road convoy, and then they would come out behind and then run alongside, chucking out bombs and machine gunning and general mayhem. Yes, that's about it.
So, Michel Pinchy was killed in September 1941.
Yes.
Not August.
Just a minute. The death of Michel Pinchy is recorded as being the 8th of September 1944.
That's on the memorial in France.
On the memorial near Aubrive, yes.